The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yeah, Miriam Bigadicuddy is with us for The Legal Lowdown. Miriam, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us again this month.
Good morning, listen. Good morning, Jerry. How are you all this morning?
Very good, very good. Keep your comments and views coming into us on the show this morning. We want to hear from you. We have a query in there, lots of queries from listeners. David gets in touch and says, hi, Jerry, Miriam. Some estates built during the boom had their own management company to maintain the upkeep of certain services such as street lighting and footpaths. I live in one such estate myself. A couple of years back, I was looking for broadband and the footpath outside my garden needed to be broken in order to get cables through. And when I signed the form to permit the broadband company to request permission from the council to break the footpath, they returned they could not authorise this as they did not have jurisdiction. This leads me to my question. We've applied for planning permission and after giving public notice, etc., we're faced with a bill from the council. Does their restricted jurisdiction have any bearing on this charge? Are they entitled to request the payment? Thanks for reading and reviewing.
Thanks, Jerry. That's I wasn't sure, actually. I think originally the charge isn't related to the original breaking of the footpath for the cables, etc. That would have been something that the management company would have authorised. I think he's talking about the planning permission charges here, which are kind of more general charges for the amenities within a town as a whole and don't link to a particular estate. I know what he's getting at there. It's kind of a contribution as part of the planning permission. I mean, years ago, say 30 years ago, if you looked at your planning permission for your house, it wouldn't have any financial contributions. But then the councils, you know, said we have to get something back for the town as a whole. And then they put financial contributions as something essential in a planning permission. It depends on the planning permission as to how much. Obviously, if it's for a builder for a big estate, the contributions would be huge. But for one individual, the contributions usually are much more reasonable.
And that's kind of where it goes from there. That's the next step to go to.
Yeah, I mean, I think what he's talking about is a financial contribution on the planning permission rather than a charge from the council in relation to the breaking up of the footpath. If they charged him from breaking up of the footpath, it could only be if the estate was in their charge anyway. But I think,
and is that the crucial point here? This isn't an estate that's been taken in charge by the council.
Exactly.
It's private.
And he's saying, arguing, why should he have to pay planning permission contributions? But they're kind of an overall contribution to the town as a whole, for being able to live in the town, as it were, and to have the amenities like the footpaths downtown, parking, at the town park.
Street cleaning.
Exactly. That's it. Yeah. The list goes on and on.
Okay, we've got a consumer query and it's a car query, pretty detailed. So a listener says, we had a 2015 van which was needing work. This would cost us €1,000. We thought it best to trade it in for a 2008 vehicle that we found on an online marketplace website. We chose this vehicle because of its engine power, its tow bar, and then it was a 7-seater for our children. This is on the 13th of March. It was a straight swap. The person who has a car sale business took our van, and in exchange, we took the 2008 vehicle he had. The very next day, the car broke down, costing €200 for us to tow it back to the garage. We asked to get the van back and was told he would fix the 2008 vehicle. Told us our van was a lot more work than we had said it was, and if he had known, he wouldn't have done the trade. Wouldn't trade the van back. I said that's the risk they take in the motor trade. It took him weeks to fix, inverted commas, the vehicle he gave us. We got a loan of a car from him, which wasn't ideal. In the end, he gave us another vehicle out of the goodness of his heart, he said. But this vehicle is defective as well and is not roadworthy, in our opinion. The engine is smoking and it's dangerous. He gave us a warranty for 30 days for this vehicle that he gave us, and it's due to expire in less than a week. What are our rights? Our original van we gave him is worth €6,000. If we take him to the small claims court over this, we could only get back €2,000 if we win. We want to get back our original van. This is pretty complicated.
Yeah, a very difficult situation, and just highlights the issues around buying second-hand vehicles in particular.
Anywhere. Online or offline.
Online or offline. And the point is, I suppose, generally, when one is dealing with the business, one has consumer rights. So if the item that was one was given, whether in a trade-in or otherwise, is not of merchantable quality, fit for purpose, you know, as described, one has a right to refund, accept a repair or replacement, etc. And the thing is to notify the business if there is a defect in the product as soon as possible after this arose. And they have done that. But often, I suppose, people do that in verbally. And I think it's very important to detail the transaction to the person and tell them what you want and give evidence in relation to the defects in the product. So I suppose one's rights to a refund arise within 30 days of receiving the product, and that one could ask them to take it back and in this case hopefully get one's van back. However, if the dealer doesn't give that back, one is stuck then, because the cheap method of remedy is the small claims court. And as the person highlighted, this only gives them €2,000 back. To get the €6,000 back, they have to go for a district court proceedings, which usually would involve getting a lawyer. So it leaves them in a very difficult situation, as well as the fact that if they hand the car back, they've no vehicle. So it's quite, and if the person, the dealer, digs in their heels, they may have to go to court to actually get that van back, which would be the item that they're, or else I suppose the €6,000 they'd be happy with either, maybe at this stage. But it means that they're carless because they've handed back the defective car. They highlighted quite rightly that the 30 day period and their rights to hand back and get what they want back, either the 6,000 or the original vehicle, they only have the 30 days to do that. I mean, I thought about, when I was thinking about this problem, I mean, ideally they should give the defective car that's smoking and dangerous back. I mean, especially if they're not comfortable driving around in it.
Yeah, and better an old car than having a car that dangerous
sounding. And demand, you know, put everything in writing, detail exactly what happened, all the defects and all that kind of thing, and that the repair replacement hasn't worked out, and detail all that and request either their van, give him the option of either the van or the 6,000. And then if he doesn't come up with the remedy, they'll have to ask themselves then, will I go on the small claims court for the €2,000, or will I institute district court proceedings to get my 6,000 stroke van back and costs? And then that leaves them in a very difficult situation where they have no car. So I suppose the best thing to do would be to look at maybe getting finance for a car over a long period of time. I mean, if you say get a loan for 5 years to purchase a vehicle, it doesn't cost too much per month, and at least it'll put them back on the road with something that's reliable. And then while they sort out this thing with the dealer. I mean, the problem is, in this case, that it might be a long haul to try and get the item back if he has been so untrustworthy, you know, all along.
And that is part of the problem. Those are the options. None of them are necessarily that palatable, but those are the options that they can go for, I suppose, to try and deal with it, Miriam. So thanks for that.
That's right. And just in relation to purchasing a new car, or sorry, not new, second-hand car, I mean, they highlighted guarantees and warranties, and they're helpful as well, obviously, if one has those with the second-hand car. But there is a buyer's checklist on the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission's website.
Go through that before you go through you sign that. The dotted line.
Yeah, we should all be going through that when we're looking at getting either a new or a second-hand car. It's very useful little checklist there.
Yeah. Yeah, 100% good information there. Okay, Miriam, we're going to have more. We have more queries to get to with the Legal Lowdown. We'll take those after we take these.
The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yeah, we're talking with Miriam McGillicuddy about the Legal Lowdown. Miriam, lots of queries coming in. A listener says, after a divorce, the family home is in both names. What exactly does that mean? and can that divorce be revisited later on? Am I wrong here? I would assume, would have assumed during a divorce that all of that would have been sorted out, or am I wrong?
Yeah, the difficulty is, especially since, even since the Celtic Tiger, when the houses were bought for huge amounts of money, there were huge mortgages taken out. And then if the parties divorce, often the mortgage institution wouldn't let both parties off the mortgage, so the house still has to be kept very often in joint names.
Yeah, until it increases the risk if it's one person paying the bills effectively.
Yeah, the mortgage company won't allow as the single person on the basis of their salary to take over the mortgage, or won't let the other person off. And that's, we found that has been a big difficulty even still. Now, as the mortgages continues to be paid off, eventually it will reach an amount that one person can take over in their own name, and once that happens, then the transfers can occur. And ideally, I suppose, if there's any lump sums to be paid, now somebody could go back if they couldn't get agreement on the rearrangements, because very often the person who's left wants to get their name off the mortgage and transfer of the house, get a lump sum if possible, and move on and get their own place and maybe take out their own mortgage down the line. Yeah. But if that's not happening by agreement, they can go back to court at any stage to get that sorted out. And what he says there is, can the divorce be revisited later on? I mean, the parties are divorced, but one can re-enter the matter to get the house sorted out, and that is possible down the line.
Okay. Another listener says, if you're nominated as a power of attorney, do you have full control of the person's assets?
Yeah, I mean, the enduring power of attorney would usually allow control over the person's personal affairs, like where they live and who visits them, how they live, and also in relation to their assets and income. That's the usual. However, when the enduring power of attorney could curtail some of that, and it's possible to restrict the enduring power of attorney
to write
as
it
well
into the power of attorney that's granted.
Yes, that it's you know, maybe only over personal affairs, not over assets, not over income. But the most usual scenario is that the person does have full control of the person's assets,
yeah,
and income, yeah, to do with as they see fit for the benefit of the person. And with the new enduring powers of attorney, they're registered with the Decision Support Service, and an annual report has to be done. So there's oversight of that control with the new enduring powers of attorney. The old ones that were done up under the old Act don't have that level of control by the Decision Support Service, and they're yet the person does have control of the person's assets. It's so important that the attorney's one appoints
are trustworthy. 100%. If a person is sole beneficiary of a will and doesn't want it, can it be then divided between the rest of the next of kin and the beneficiary?
Yeah, I mean, one could disclaim maybe part of a will, but it's part of one's gift. Usually one can only disclaim the whole of the gift, and then it would go to the other parties who are entitled. One has to be very careful about this in terms of tax, because it could have tax implications. Say, for example, if a parent disclaimed in favour of their children, the tax thresholds are lower for grandchildren, and it could leave a big tax bill. Effectively, what the scenario this person is outlining would effectively be a transfer to the rest of the next of kin from them, and that they keep a certain amount of the gift and then are transferring over to the other next of kin. But it is possible to work disclaimers whereby one almost rejects a gift, if you know what I mean. And one could look at how that would work in the scenario with the solicitor and just make sure about the tax implications.
Okay, Miriam, we bought a second-hand car from Dublin, imported from a car from a garage in Dublin. He could not provide a spare key. Are we entitled to one? Do we have rights to demand one?
Unfortunately, unless it was advertised on the tin, one gets a car and usually one key with
it.
The second-hand car. Yeah, unless it was something one specifically contracted for at the time. And I know it's very annoying for this listener because the second keys often cost a fortune, but he could contact his local garage and see if they could get one at good value for him. Yeah, one would have need to have written it into the contract. Very often when one is buying a new car, they might give a spare key as part of the deal.
Yeah.
I think one usually gets that as a kind of a standard thing with a new car, but not necessarily with the second-hand one, okay, unless it's part of the contract.
Okay, Miriam, great stuff. Thanks for answering all those queries. Lots more in for you. We will get to those this time next month, but thanks for talking to us this morning.
Thank you very much, Gerry, and thank you, listeners.
There you go, that's listener Miriam McGillicuddy in with us for the Legal Lowdown. She'll be back with us at the end of May. If you have a view on that, get in touch with us on the programme. Any more questions, pass them on to us now and we'll get them on to Miriam in the meantime.